Hi, this is John McEwen with the Americana Music Show on syndicatednews.net. And today, I have a special guest, an unusual behind-the-scenes type of person in the music business. And she's been in the scenes, only she's been reporting about them for the last 20 years, one way or another. And she recently started her own magazine, as she's a publisher and writer, editor. Oh, she'll tell us about it. Suzanne Kajin, are you there?
Hi, John.
Hi.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having you. My pleasure. I think you're the first female on this show.
I'm breaking the glass ceiling.
I'm curious, Suzanne, how does a person like you start writing about music, and when was that?
Well, I've been a writer for, I went to college for it about a zillion years ago when colleges were new. And I was a writer. And I wrote about what I loved, and I wrote about food, and I wrote about music. In order to make a living, I wrote about a few other things like international trade, but that was never my chosen focus.
What was your first music interview?
My first music interview, my God. I want to say Buffalo Springfield, but that was... not. I think it was Three Dog Night. Three Dog Night.
Was it when it was still the original group?
Oh, I told you I'm old. They were going on their first European tour, as a matter of fact.
Oh my gosh.
About 69, maybe, I'm guessing. 68, even.
Three Dog Night was breaking records in concert attendance at the time when they sold out the Tampa Stadium. It was a big deal.
And, they were a big deal.
Yeah. And their music is quite an impact. Hoyt Axton was a good friend of mine, and he did some stuff. And he did some songs that they did. Well, you've been writing going back to all those days of when people were really, I think, this is a question I had for you. Did it seem to you like people back then were more into the music and knowing about it than they may be in general now?
Probably, yes. And it's a little hard for me to tell now, to compare then and now, because I'm much more accustomed to dealing with people in the music industry now than I was then. So most people that I talk to are educated about music. Right. Mm-hmm. Now. But when I really started out in college, certainly it was in the late 60s, early 70s, and music was a big deal. I mean, that was the golden age of folk and rock music, and everybody had it in their heads all the time. I mean, there was no event that you went to that wasn't music related, pretty much. I mean, even if you went on Vietnam peace marches, you know, there were people singing the rock and roll and folk anthems, like anti-war anthems.
It seems to me, when I first picked up an Elmore magazine, of which you're the publisher and the editor, it was an instant breath of fresh air in reporting about music, because it seemed to go into talking about it and listening to what the musicians or the singers or the songwriters had to say. Is that your intention, to harken back to the days when reporters actually reported about what was going on?
Well, first of all, let me digress for a second, because you were a breath of fresh air to me, too, because you have such a great sense of humor. and a lot of people in music are very serious. But yes, we do. We try to connect the past with the present and the future. And we cover what we call American music with a history: blues, jazz, country, rock and roll, and folk, but no hip hop, for example, no rap. And get into, as I say, sort of connecting the past with the present.
You've been published by all kinds of magazines like Brides and Gourmet and different people. How does that experience make you have a good music magazine, which it is?
Wow, that's a good question. I'm used to being edited. I demand clean copy, because I've had it demanded of me in the past. It's a little hard to say. I mean, it's all an educational process. You learn every place you go from everybody you meet.
Just to wow some people, speaking of everybody you meet and interview, who's the biggest interview in the last 10 or 15 years that you've done music-related?
Biggest?
Well, biggest name, well-known, not even the biggest commercial name, but somebody that's really hip, maybe, in your eyes and also your readers.
Well, I'm not so sure that's a universal question. I mean, I've certainly had as much fun with Gregory Allman as I've had with anybody on the line. John Mellencamp is a smart guy, very funny, very wry. I mean, I said, what's your Desert Island CD? And he says, you mean like New York City, Manhattan. Seeger was on for an hour and a half or thereabouts and sang complete songs to me.
Who was that? Who was on an hour and a half? I didn't get that. Who was on an hour and a half?
Pete Seeger.
Oh, you did say Pete Seeger. Yeah.
Les Paul, again, very funny. Wow. You know, I did his last interview, and my partner, who's a photographer, my partner in the magazine, I should say, who's a photographer, took the last photographs of him, which now are in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And Les told me, I was up all night last night working on a new hearing aid. You know, I mean, the guy was phenomenal. Those people impress me. I'm not sure who the biggest name is, but those are certainly some of my favorites.
Well, I saw Les Paul playing with his trio at the Iridium in New York, and he just blew me away. I mean, he wasn't necessarily as fast as he's ever been, had ever been, but he certainly was as tasteful and was really fun to watch. You also interviewed Little Milton, and what was that like?
Little Milton, I interviewed him at an Avery Fisher Hall concert, which was I'm trying to remember the name of it, but it was a whole bunch of blues guys. I mean, Pine Top Perkins and Robert Lockwood Jr. Mm-hmm. And a whole bunch of guys. Anyways, and Little Milton was he was terrific. He was funny. He was very friendly and nice. The kind of funny thing about it was that he was the youngest guy there at 70. And yeah, exactly. And he went home with when I say he went home, one of the women who was organizing it, who was probably about 25 or 30. Drove him home, and he hit on her.
Well,
and then died about 2 weeks later.
And he's recently won four blues awards, and he didn't even have to be around for it.
No, so. He didn't. That's right.
You had the last professional interview with him. And
is that true? I'm not sure of that, but that may be very well be possible.
No, it's true. It's quite a thing that I'm getting it confirmed right now. It's quite a thing to be in your position, because often people open up to a writer because you're friendly and communicators, which I always think songwriters and musicians are, even sometimes they don't know it. Well, I don't know. I just play my music and I hope people like it. Or, you know, somebody that just sits there and writes songs, but they are communicators. Even Ramblin' Jack Elliott, I was hanging out with him backstage once, and he was telling a story and laughing, and it was about 2 minutes before he had to go on. He goes, oh, I got to get ready for my show. And he started kind of looking lost and rambly and talking different, and he moved into his character. I had the same thing happen in Amsterdam. I ran into Tom Waits. And we hadn't seen each other in 10 years. And, hey, John, how you doing? And I'm really good to see you. Yeah, I've been over here for a couple of weeks. And that's because I was on the inside. And then I moved to the outside about 10 minutes into the conversation. And he started saying, well, yeah, I got to go get me a $5 room. You know, I have a $6 room, and that's a little too much for me. And I'm fine in a $5 room. And he went into the Tom Waits character.
Right. I would love to meet that guy.
One show we did with the Eagles, where they all showed up, and they were, this was in the 70s, and they're all in really nice suits and clothes and stuff. And they, well, we better go change for the show. And they put on the torn Levi's and dirty T-shirts. Now, but you get to see people. You get to pull the curtain back, and they often open up to you. What would maybe be one of the biggest revelations that you can pull out of your memory on?
Wow. Oh, you know, I'm not sure I can put a lot of this on the air, but...
it's not air, it's internet.
Well, we just printed this, so I guess it's okay. I called Bobby Rush, who's a terrific blues performer and a very dynamic performer, and he had been playing at South by Southwest.
Uh-huh.
And he went to see Pine Top Perkins play. Pine Top Perkins went to see Bobby Rush play. Pine Top was 97 at the time, and they had played together many, many times. Bobby's probably 75, 70, I'm not sure. And they hung out after the show, and Pine Top only eats McDonald's and for breakfast, I'm talking about, too. And so I'm talking to Bobby, and Bobby says to me, yeah, you know, I said to Pine Top, hey, Pine Top, how's your love life, to this 97-year-old? And Pine Top says, well, it's a little shaky, but I get a little every now and then. And he died the next day.
Oh, my God. He might have gotten a little too much.
I mean, you know, he died a happy man. Maybe I shouldn't be laughing, but he really did die a happy man at 97.
I'm sure he was laughing.
I'm sure he was laughing. People do open up quite a bit. I was on the phone with one guy, and I'm not going to tell you his name, but he's a household name. And I was on the phone with him, and he was opening his mail while he was talking to me. And all of a sudden he goes, oh, my God, it came through. Oh, my divorce came through. And he goes, he's opening his mail and he finds out that he's no longer married. I mean, things like that you can't make up.
Well, out of all your interviews, is there one, necessarily not the biggest name, but maybe the biggest name to you, the one that you went, oh, man, I'm interviewing Ella Fitzgerald, you know, the one that meant a lot to you. I know they all mean something to you, and you write very sensitive, well-done articles. And anybody that picks up an Elmore magazine will find that her other writers are of the same level. It's really a fun read, Elmore.
I'm thinking, I mean, Les Paul really meant a lot to me, and it meant more later because he passed away so soon. I mean, you know, I was one of the last people to talk to him. And he's really was and remains such a historic and wonderful man as a person. And certainly he changed rock and roll by inventing, you know, double tracking and the electric guitar.
Did you know about Les Paul's accomplishments prior to the interview?
Oh, yes. I knew him prior to the interview. I've known him for some years. In fact, with some soul searching, I had a chance to see Paul McCartney play in front of about 300 or 400 people or go to Les Paul's 80th birthday party, and I went to Les Paul's party. Sorry,
Paul. I was fortunate to be. I asked Les Paul a few questions, and for those that don't know, I was fortunate to be able to ask Mr. Paul a few questions, or which part of your career is the most rewarding to you? Was it that you invented multi-track recording so rock and roll bands could make a lot of instruments all by themselves on one session, or that you invented the guitar, or the Les Paul humbucking pickup, or the hit record you had with Mary Ford? And this, there's probably something else.
That's a good question.
He said, they're all like children. I love them all.
Oh, that's great. That's typical. That's great. That's a great answer. He was a wonderful man.
Yeah, very, very cordial guy. Have there been times when you met somebody that was purported to be, oh, this guy's a real jerk, and you found out, much to your surprise, that it went really smooth?
I've been warned away from a couple of people and found them to be nice. Most of the people that I was warned about were actually not very nice, to tell the truth. I mean, Ike Turner was not a nice man. There are a few guys who
Did you interview Ike Turner?
I did.
Oh my God.
I did. I interviewed Ike Turner, and he was
rough and
kind of a bully.
What year? For those that don't know, I would assume there's not very many, but Ike Turner was Tina's keeper, kept her under camera surveillance in the house. And this is in the 70s when people didn't have that ability usually, but he had cameras on her. It's like he kept her in a cage. He kept a machine gun under the mixing board.
Sometimes
he'd pull it out and point it at somebody and say, play. The stories I've heard from musicians, he'd fire guns in the studio. I was at Liberty Records. Well, one reason was I was assigned artist to Liberty Records, Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, the day Ike was coming in, and he demanded a bag of cash. I need $35,000 cash today. And if I don't get it, you're not getting the album. He made them give him a bag of cash.
Well, he's not the only one. He's not the only one who demands cash or demanded cash. And I think a lot of the older performers who got gypped out of things, both from their record companies and probably from the club owners, were very wary of that. And Chuck Berry is certainly a prime example of that. You know, he's in there, gets his cash, does his thing, and he's out of there. He's like a ghost.
I was doing a show opening for Chuck Berry once, and my son Jonathan was with me, and he wanted to get his autograph. Jonathan was about 14 or 15, maybe 16 at the time. And so his band was doing their sound check, and I'm chatting it up with the band and the drummer I got to know, and he'd been playing with Chuck Berry for 6 months. And I said, so when your boss shows up, would he be able to sign an autograph, you think? Well, I don't know. You'll have to ask him. I've never met him. He's never met.
And did your son get the autograph?
Yes.
Really?
Very reluctantly, as Chuck was sitting in his car getting ready to pull away. But the look on his face, I would have paid for. It was as if I was removing one of his feet.
That's probably right.
So a question I would like to know from you, in your experience, most of the people that I've recorded with or played with or met that I like to remember, Dolly Parton, Willie Nelson, Garth Brooks, all very nice people. When I recorded Dolly Parton on the Steve Martin album, I sent her a couple of faxes because she dealt with faxes. And, well, I'll be glad to try to sing that and see if I can do a good job. And if I don't, I'll just sing harmony instead of lead, or I'll just watch. You know, I mean, very humble. To me, nice pays off. And I'm not sure that not nice pays off for long, although some people do have a career when they're not nice. For you, do you feel like a lot of the people you've interviewed are grateful or nice?
Certainly they're nice, and I think most of them are grateful. The very biggest stars who get deluged with requests for interviews and photo ops and tickets to their shows or whatever people want from them, free CDs, I don't know. Those people are very businesslike, you know, and it doesn't mean that they're not nice, but they know that it's show business. It's not, you know, it's not a fun thing. It may be a fun thing to do, but this is their livelihood. And they have to manage their time, and they have to manage what they say. And it doesn't mean that they're not nice.
One of the things that is difficult about this business is often there can be a 20-hour travel day to get to where you're going to do a two-hour set, followed by getting on the bus for another 12 hours to get to the next place, and the sound check is bad. And somewhere in that second day, maybe, you've been out there for 40 hours. You haven't really slept in a bed or eaten anything that was good. And somebody says, hey, can you sign this for me? you can make the mistake of going, look, just give me a minute, okay? And they'll say, what a jerk.
Right.
You know, and so you really have to be on your guard. I've been guilty of that a time or two, and unfortunately, there's one guy in Omaha that I need to say I'm sorry to from 1978, but I haven't run across him again. I don't think he's going to show up. But in general, it's a tough game. You also catch people. Okay, here's a question I'm curious about. You go in for a 15-minute interview. Does it turn into 30 sometimes? Like this?
Oh, all the time. It's very rare. I mean, very rare that you go for a half an hour interview and don't spend more time with them. It's very rare, and that's my experience.
Well, that's a compliment. That's a compliment to your style, your writing and interviewing. It's also an indication of how Elmore Magazine is, I believe, for those that are curious, Elmore Magazine, named after who and why?
Elmore James, who was an old blues guy who basically invented slide guitar as we know it today.
Mm-hmm.
What, you have a different impression of Elmore James?
No, I'm just curious why you chose him.
Oh, because it's an American kind of common, when I say common, I don't mean usual. I mean, you'll never find a Sir Elmore wandering around. It's a man of the people kind of name, and it's catchy, and most real music fans know who he is or recognize something about it. You know, we had 2 days worth of figuring out what name we were going to name this magazine. It also fits on a masthead.
I got a suggestion for your magazine.
Please.
Every month you have a little square that says Elmore Facts, and it's things like bought his first slide when he was 12 or stuff like that.
Oh, I don't think he bought a slide ever. No. I think he used bottlenecks, whatever he could find.
Well, my point is a little square that would tell people the Elmore fact of this issue is...
I hope to be in business long enough to run out of those facts about Elmore James. So we could start with him and move on to other people, Robert Johnson or, Woody Guthrie or somebody like that. I think, you know, icons of their genres. I think that's a great idea. Thank you. Do I owe you 2% or something on that?
Just another issue, maybe.
Okay.
Do you consider this Americana music? What is it? Folk music, like Elmore James and some of the people you cover in general?
Americana is a pretty broad concept, and I think it fits in with what we're doing. I think some of the rock and roll that we cover would not necessarily be considered Americana. And I think of people like ZZ Top and... I can think of their song, but I can't think of the band.
Mm.
Oh, anyways, I just dropped it. I'm sorry. But there are some people I think who would not be considered Americana that we cover, but I think 80% of what we cover is Americana. And that to me includes blues and folk and, American music, not classical, not world music, mm-hmm. not synthesizers, but something based out of the American heritage, as it were.
I want to make a statement that I want your approval of, and it can be edited out. And I'm curious, is what made you start basically a new career, a new business somewhere you went? And the reason I bring this up, a lot of our listeners are definitely in our age bracket. And you didn't say, I'm done. You said, I'm going to start a magazine and make it a hit. What made you do that?
Well, I had been retired for a little while, and I'd done reasonably well in my previous life, and I got bored. And this friend of mine, Arnie Goodman, who is now my partner in the magazine, kept saying, "Oh, I know. I was doing the newsletter for the New York Blues Society, which I helped start with a couple of other people. And I wound up raising my hand once too often and becoming the editor of the newsletter. And my friend Arnie kept saying to me, "Oh, Suzanne, you should do a real magazine. You should do a real magazine," because this was, a 16-page newsletter. And we sat around in my living room and cooked this up. I didn't really realize that we were in business until I got a $1,400 bill from the copyright office for the trademark of the name. And I'm going, wow, this is a lot of money. I thought, we're in business. We're going to do this. And, you know, we've been doing it ever since.
What's your average? You started 6 years ago about, and what's your average circulation now?
Okay, it runs around 20,000.
That's really healthy. That's great. You know, but I believe as the word spreads of this cool magazine, and it's going to grow for sure. And how do people find it?
Well, we're in Barnes and Nobles across the country. We've got a which does not mean every Barnes and Nobles, but we are in Barnes and Nobles across the country, and we'd love to be in every one of them. You have to go in and ask in some cases. We're available by subscription, which you can get to from www.elmoremagazine.com. And occasionally we go to music festivals where we distribute the magazine. We'll be at the ASCAP conference in Los Angeles in the end of April, getting the word out. There's always a new way to make people aware of the magazine, and we're trying all of them, frankly.
Do you have a Facebook page?
We do have a Facebook page. It's Elmore Magazine, I believe.
Do you do Twitter?
We tweet from time to time. I personally tweet very little, but we have younger people in the audience, under 50 people in the office, who are more likely to tweet than I.
Well, you said a phrase that's very important to the current music business, but it's always been important, is getting the word out. Lately, it's just more difficult than ever in the information age, when there's 15,000 websites probably 150,000 websites for new music, and there's places to go, and there's new bands and new songs, and it's like everybody's firing off shotguns, and you can't find any of the bullets. And it's getting the word out is what made the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band have a career. We had people writing about us in the 70s as much as giving us airplay. A lot of the airplay we got, the stations didn't identify that it was the group that made the record. They just played the record and went on, you know.
And you didn't have the advantage of having someone be able to Google your lyrics and find out who wrote it or who performed it.
And getting the word out, having people talk about new music, which you do a lot, and understanding where it came from, I think it's really great that Elmore pays homage to where a lot of things came from, like your jazz issue with All About Jazz and Dizzy Gillespie and Louis Armstrong and everybody. It's a great, that's one of the best reads on jazz I've ever seen. It explains it for people that don't really listen to it.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I had a lot of fun writing that, and I love the guy from Lincoln Center, the head of the Lincoln Center jazz operation, who said, I want the day to come when Duke Ellington's picture is in every classroom, just the way Lincoln's picture or George Washington's picture is.
Well, as well it should be. That would be a good thing.
One thing I'd love to emphasize here is that people should go out and hear live music. They really should. It's an exhilarating experience. I know that, you know, it's much easier to YouTube somebody, but going out and hearing a whole set of a live musician, something that you'll never hear again. I mean, nobody can ever do the same performance exactly the same every time. And you're standing in a different part of the room. I mean, Les Paul told me that. He said he can't go to the movies because he sits in one seat, and then he sits in another, and then he sits in the third, trying to find the best audio experience in the theater. But there's so much out there, as you say, that it's hard to separate what's good and what's not. And that's one of the functions I think that Elmore is trying to perform, which is to sift out some of the chaff and to guide readers to decent music. Some people say to us, oh, Suzanne, you never run a bad review. You never pan anybody. And I say, no, the people that we don't like just don't get ink. That's all. why should we waste, you know, a few precious inches of column space saying, don't buy this album? We only talk about people that we think are good. Not perfect, but good.
Yeah, there's a lot of hardworking, good people. There's a lady in Brooklyn that just works her tail off singing, and she's really good, but she has to have a regular job in order to pay for it. And Martha Redbone is an example. Well, she's not the one I was thinking of, but Martha Redbone is someone I'm working on a project with. You've met her before, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I mean, this is her life, music. She's always talking about it, working on it, and people need to know how good she is. And you're offering that service, and it's a wonderful thing.
And encouraging people to go out and hear her, go to festivals. I mean, festivals are some of the best values you'll get. You can go for free, you can go for $25, you can go for $40, and hear a day's worth of music, maybe 3 days worth of music, from 11 o'clock in the morning until 11 o'clock at night. Where can you do that?
The other girl I was talking about is Jen Larson.
Oh, yeah.
And she's like an Irish dement type of singer, but mm-hmm. she can't make the other side of the word work for her yet, music business.
Mm-hmm.
And
I have to say that I went to a seminar recently, and I heard a guy talk about funding his band,
mm-hmm.
and they had some very creative things to do. Can I give you an example or two? Because
sure.
I was blown away. He had somebody in the band who was a baker, and they said, who knew how to bake, mm-hmm. and they said, for $500, we will bake you your wedding cake. It's a $500 donation to the band to put out their next CD. And they got 100 people who wanted wedding cakes at $500 a pop. They'll sell signed lyrics. They'll come and perform at your house, you know, for a fixed fee, basically. Mm-hmm. And that fee goes to producing their album or funding their tour or buying gas, and they tell you what it's for. It was a very interesting concept, and I think a lot of young bands are doing that.
I've got some brownies in the oven right now. In fact, I've got about 900 pounds of brownies. It's such a good idea. I'm taking off right now. That's a good idea.
There are a lot of ways, and you know, and we recently did a story about syndication and sync rights, not syndication, sync rights, and how young bands can support themselves, maybe not terribly well in the beginning, but they can support themselves by selling music to commercials, to television programs, as background music to something. And maybe you don't feel like you're getting your artistic due, but you get $8,000 and up, and you know that buys some strings for your guitar, and that buys some food and rent.
What the listener may not know is when Suzanne says sync rights, that means the right to synchronize the music with some form of picture or something, whether it's a commercial or a dance or something. And music
a
has
movie.
Rights.
Yeah,
a movie, and the right to use that is something that's paid for separately. And that doesn't mean they own the song. It means they own the right to use the song in their own way. And it is definitely a way to help raise funds. And commercials, what's the difference between a commercial and a commercial song? If, you know, Paul Williams rode into town in a stolen car in L.A. and he was working on a bank commercial, and somebody said, hey, is that a whole song? And he said, well, not really. We'll finish it. And I know this group is just recording, and they could use that. It was a song we've only just begun. And he finished it, and they gave it to the carpenters that were working in the
wow.
studio a floor down, and he paid for the stolen car.
That's it. That is a success story. That's great. I have one from the opposite side where, oh, I don't know, 20 years ago, maybe more, I heard a commercial on television for Lifesavers, and it was Mint Lifesavers. And in the background was this very terrific harmony going rain, 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 rain. And I went around to every record store I know, and there were record stores then. There was Sam Goody's and Tower Records. And I went around singing this song and looking for it, and it was Ladysmith's Black Mambazo.
Oh.
Nobody had heard of them, but they had gotten there. And, I went out and bought the album. I have, you know, an LP of Ladysmith's Black Mambazo, their first release. But I found them, and I have to say, with some effort, because of a commercial that they were on.
Well, what's his name? Barry Manilow did a lot of commercials in the early days. And I never will forget one of the first concerts that the Dirt Band did in the South was in Davidson, North Carolina. And Bojangles was huge. And we were playing the main concert hall, 1,500 seats. Oh, it doesn't need to get any bigger than this. And the guy that booked us says, come with me for a little while. He took me downstairs I booked this duo down here. I want to see what you think of them. And he paid him $500 to play for 4 hours, and it was Bette Midler and Barry Manilow.
Oh, my God.
and I say that for a couple of reasons. You never know where something's going to go. Original music will lead you towards better things. And persistence. And you, Suzanne, have had a lot of persistence with your magazine and your work. And I just wanted to say, direct people again. We're talking to Suzanne Kajin, editor and owner of Elmore Magazine, one of the coolest new music magazines out there. And if you like music, you'll love Elmore.
Thank you very much, Kevin. I have to say that you call me persistent. My friends call me stubborn, but I really appreciate that shift.
Well, to make anything succeed, I believe it takes persistence, according to Napoleon Hill, anyway. Mm-hmm. If you're not persistent, all persistence is an expression of belief in what you're doing. And
that's true, and it also tends to make you better at it. There was a famous golfer who said, one of the early golfers said, golf is a game of luck. The more I practice, the luckier I get.
I like Bing Crosby's quote. He was about 85 years old. There, somebody was asking him in Palm Springs about life and stuff. He goes, "Well, for a golfer, I did pretty good as a singer."
Oh, that's great.
Well, Suzanne, it's been great visiting with you. And if there's anything you would like to impart to the audience that may be listening, what would that be?
It would be probably go and see John McEwen live.
No, you can't do that. Edit point. Thank you.
Get out and see live music. Read about it. Learn about it. The more you know about it, about music, the more you'll appreciate it. You really will. It makes a huge difference to listen to music, really listen to it, as opposed to have it background music and to hear individual songs on random on your iPod. Listen to
right.
Listen to several songs, an album if you can, by one performer straight through and get a sense of who they are. And believe me, you'll appreciate it. And you'll probably like some songs that you wouldn't have heard on the radio or wouldn't be downloading from iTunes.
Thanks for visiting with us on the Americana Music Show. This is John McEwen speaking with Suzanne Kajin.
Thank you so much, John. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Thank you. Hi, this is John McEwen with the Americana Music Show on syndicatednews.net. And today, I have a special guest, an unusual behind-the-scenes type of person in the music business. And she's been in the scenes, only she's been reporting about them for the last 20 years, one way or another. And she recently started her own magazine. She's a publisher and writer, editor. Oh, she'll tell us about it. Suzanne Kajin, are you there?
Hi, John.
Hi.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having you. My pleasure. I think you're the first female on this show.
I'm breaking the glass ceiling.
I'm curious, Suzanne, how does a person like you start writing about music, and when was that?
Well, I've been a writer for, I went to college for it about a zillion years ago when colleges were new. And I was a writer, and I wrote about what I loved, and I wrote about food, and I wrote about music. In order to make a living, I wrote about a few other things like international trade, but that was never my chosen focus.
What was your first music interview?
My first music interview, my God. I want to say Buffalo Springfield, but that was not. I think it was Three Dog Night. Three Dog Night.
Was it when it was still the original group?
Oh, I told you, I'm old. They were going on their first European tour, as a matter of fact.
Oh, my gosh.
About 69, maybe, I'm guessing. 68, even.
Three Dog Night was breaking records in concert attendance at the time when they sold out the Tampa Stadium. It was a big deal.
And, they were a big deal.
Yeah. And their music is quite an impact. Hoyt Axton was a good friend of mine, and he did some stuff, and he did some songs that they did. Well, you've been writing going back to all those days of when people were really, I think, and this is a question I had for you, did it seem to you like people back then were more into the music and knowing about it than they may be in general now?
Probably, yes, and it's a little hard for me to tell now, to compare then and now, because I'm much more accustomed to dealing with people in the music industry now than I was then. So most people that I talk to are educated about music right now. But when I really started out in college, certainly it was in the late 60s, early 70s, and music was a big deal. I mean, that was the golden age of folk and rock music, and everybody had it in their heads all the time. I mean, there was no event that you went to that wasn't music related, pretty much. I mean, even if you went on Vietnam peace marches, you know, there were people singing the rock and roll and folk anthems, like anti-war anthems.
It seems to me, when I first picked up an Elmore magazine, of which you're the publisher and editor, it was an instant breath of fresh air in reporting about music, because it seemed to go into talking about it and listening to what the musicians or the singers or the songwriters had to say. Is that your intention, to harken back to the days when reporters actually reported about what was going on?
Well, first of all, let me digress for a second, because you were a breath of fresh air to me too, because you have such a great sense of humor, and a lot of people in music are very serious. But yes, we do. We try to connect the past with the present and the future, and we cover what we call American music with a history: blues, jazz, country, rock and roll, and folk. But no hip hop, for example, no rap. And get into, as I say, sort of connecting the past with the present.
You've been published by all kinds of magazines like Brides and Gourmet and different people. How does that experience make you have a good music magazine, which it is?
Wow, that's a good question. I'm used to being edited. I demand clean copy because I've had it demanded of me in the past. It's a little hard to say. I mean, it's all an educational process. You know, you learn every place you go from everybody you meet.
Well, just to wow some people, speaking of everybody you meet and interview, who's the biggest interview in the last 10 or 15 years that you've done music-related?
Biggest?
Well, biggest name, well-known, not even the biggest commercial name, but somebody that is really hip, maybe, in your eyes and also your readers?
Well, I'm not so sure that that's a universal question. I mean, I've certainly had as much fun with Gregory Allman as I've had with anybody on the line. John Mellencamp is a smart guy, very funny, very wry. I mean, I said, what's your Desert Island CD? And he says, you mean like New York City, Manhattan. Speaker was on for an hour and a half or thereabouts and sang complete songs to me.
Who was that? Who was on an hour and a half? I didn't get that. Who was on an hour and a half?
Pete Seeger.
Oh, you did say Pete Seeger. Yeah.
Les Paul, again, very funny.
Wow.
You know, I did his last interview, and my partner, who's a photographer, my partner in the magazine, I should say, who's a photographer, took the last photographs of him, which now are in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And Les told me, I was up all night last night working on a new hearing aid. You know, I mean, the guy was phenomenal. Those people impress me. I'm not sure who the biggest name is, but those are certainly some of my favorites.
Well, I saw Les Paul playing with his trio at the Iridium in New York, and he just blew me away. I mean, he wasn't necessarily as fast as he's ever been, had ever been, but he certainly was as tasteful and was really fun to watch. You also interviewed Little Milton, and what was that like?
Little Milton, I interviewed him at an Avery Fisher Hall concert, which was I'm trying to remember the name of it, but it was a whole bunch of blues guys. I mean, Pine Top Perkins and Robert Lockwood Jr. And a whole bunch of guys. Anyways, and Little Milton was he was terrific. He was funny. He was very friendly and nice. The kind of funny thing about it was that he was the youngest guy there at 70. And yeah, exactly. And he went home with when I say he went home, one of the women who was organizing it, who was probably about 25 or 30. Drove him home, and he hit on her.
Well,
and then died about 2 weeks later.
And he's recently won four blues awards, and he didn't even have to be around for it.
No, so. He did. That's right.
You had the last professional interview with him. And
is that true? I'm not sure of that, but that may be very well be possible.
No, it's true. It's quite a thing that I'm getting it confirmed right now. It's quite a thing to be in your position, because often people open up to a writer because you're friendly and communicators, which I always think songwriters and musicians are, even sometimes they don't know it. Well, I don't know. I just play my music and I hope people like it. Or, you know, somebody that just sits there and writes songs, but they are communicators. Even Ramblin' Jack Elliott, I was hanging out with him backstage once, and he was telling a story and laughing, and it was about 2 minutes before he had to go on. He goes, oh, I got to get ready for my show. And he started kind of looking lost and rambly and talking different, and he moved into his character. I had the same thing happen in Amsterdam. I ran into Tom Waits. And we hadn't seen each other in 10 years. And, hey, John, how you doing? And I'm really good to see you. Yeah, I've been over here for a couple of weeks. And that's because I was on the inside. And then I moved to the outside about 10 minutes into the conversation. And he started saying, well, yeah, I got to go get me a $5 room. You know, I have a $6 room, and that's a little too much for me. And I'm fine in a $5 room. And he went into the Tom Waits character.
Right. I would love to meet that guy.
One show we did with the Eagles, they all showed up, and this was in the 70s, and they were all in really nice suits and clothes and stuff. And they, well, we better go change for the show. And they put on the torn Levi's and dirty T-shirts. Now, but you get to see people. You get to pull the curtain back, and they often open up to you. What would maybe be one of the biggest revelations that you can pull out of your memory on?
Wow. Oh, you know? I'm not sure I can put a lot of this on the air, but
it's not air, it's internet.
We just printed this, so I guess it's okay. I called Bobby Rush, who's a terrific blues performer and a very dynamic performer, and he had been playing at South by Southwest.
Uh-huh.
And he went to see Pine Top Perkins play. Pine Top Perkins went to see Bobby Rush play. Pine Top was 97 at the time, and they had played together many, many times. Bobby's probably 75, 70, I'm not sure. And they hung out after the show, and Pine Top only eats McDonald's and for breakfast, I'm talking about, too. And so I'm talking to Bobby, and Bobby says to me, yeah, you know, I said to Pine Top, hey, Pine Top, how's your love life, to this 97-year-old? And Pine Top says, well, it's a little shaky, but I get a little every now and then. And he died the next day.
Oh, my God. He might have gotten a little too much.
I mean, you know, he died a happy man. Maybe I shouldn't be laughing, but he really did die a happy man at 97.
I'm sure he was laughing.
I'm sure he was laughing. People do open up quite a bit. I was on the phone with one guy, and I'm not going to tell you his name, but he's a household name. And I was on the phone with him, and he was opening his mail while he was talking to me. And all of a sudden he goes, oh, my God, it came through. Oh, my divorce came through. And he goes, he's opening his mail, and he finds out that he's no longer married. I mean, things like that you can't make up.
Well, out of all your interviews, is there one, necessarily not the biggest name, but maybe the biggest name to you, the one that you went, oh, man, I'm interviewing Ella Fitzgerald, you know, the one that meant a lot to you. I know they all mean something to you, and you write very sensitive, well-done articles. And anybody that picks up an Elmore magazine will find that her other writers are of the same level. It's really a fun read, Elmore.
I'm thinking, I mean, Les Paul really meant a lot to me, and it meant more later because he passed away so soon. I mean, you know, I was one of the last people to talk to him. And he's really was and remains such a historic and wonderful man as a person. And certainly he changed rock and roll by inventing, you know, double tracking and the electric guitar.
Did you know about Les Paul's accomplishments prior to the interview?
Oh, yes. I knew him prior to the interview. I've known him for some years. In fact, with some soul searching, I had a chance to see Paul McCartney play in front of about 300 or 400 people or go to Les Paul's 80th birthday party, and I went to Les Paul's party. Sorry,
Paul. I was fortunate to be. I asked Les Paul a few questions, and for those that don't know, I was fortunate to be able to ask Mr. Paul a few questions. Or which part of your career is the most rewarding to you? Was it that you invented multi-track recording so rock and roll bands could make a lot of instruments all by themselves on one session? Or that you invented the guitar or the Les Paul humbucking pickup or the hit record you had with Mary Ford? And this, there's probably something else.
That's a good question.
He said, they're all like children. I love them all.
Oh, that's great. That's typical. That's great. That's a great answer. He was a wonderful man.
Yeah, very, very cordial guy. Have there been times when you met somebody that was purported to be, oh, this guy's a real jerk, and you found out, much to your surprise, that it went really smooth?
I've been warned away from a couple of people and found them to be nice. Most of the people that I was warned about were actually not very nice, to tell the truth. I mean, Ike Turner was not a nice man. There are a few guys who
Did you interview Ike Turner?
I did.
Oh, my God.
I did. I interviewed Ike Turner, and he was
rough
and kind of a bully.
What year? For those that don't know, I would assume there's not very many, but Ike Turner was Tina's keeper. Kept her under camera surveillance in the house, and this is in the 70s when people didn't have that ability usually, but he had cameras on her. It's like he kept her in a cage. He kept a machine gun under the mixing board.
Sometimes
he'd pull it out and point it at somebody and say, "Play." The stories I've heard from musicians, he'd fire guns in the studio. I was at Liberty Records. Well, one reason was I was assigned artist to Liberty Records, Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. The day Ike was coming in, and he demanded a bag of cash. "I need $35,000 cash today. And if I don't get it, you're not getting the album." He made them give him a bag of cash.
Well, he's not the only one. He's not the only one who demands cash or demanded cash. And I think a lot of the older performers who got gypped out of things, both from their record companies and probably from the club owners, were very wary of that. And Chuck Berry is certainly a prime example of that. You know, he's in there, gets his cash, does his thing, and he's out of there. He's like a ghost.
I was doing a show opening for Chuck Berry once, and my son Jonathan was with me, and he wanted to get his autograph. Jonathan was about 14 or 15, maybe 16 at the time. And so his band was doing their sound check, and I'm chatting it up with the band and the drummer I got to know, and he'd been playing with Chuck Berry for 6 months. And I said, "So when your boss shows up, would he be able to sign an autograph, you think?" "Well, I don't know. You'll have to ask him. I've never met him." He's never met.
And did your son get the autograph?
Yes.
Really?
Very reluctantly, as Chuck was sitting in his car getting ready to pull away. But the look on his face, I would have paid for. It was as if I was removing one of his feet.
That's probably right.
So a question I would like to know from you, in your experience, most of the people that I've recorded with or played with or met that I like to remember, Dolly Parton, Willie Nelson, Garth Brooks, all very nice people. When I recorded Dolly Parton on the Steve Martin album, I sent her a couple of faxes because she dealt with faxes. And, "Well, I'll be glad to try to sing that and see if I can do a good job. And if I don't, I'll just sing harmony instead of lead, or I'll just watch." You know, I mean, very humble. To me, nice pays off. And I'm not sure that not nice pays off for long, although some people do have a career when they're not nice. For you, do you feel like a lot of the people you've interviewed are grateful or nice?
Certainly they're nice, and I think most of them are grateful. The very biggest stars who get deluged with requests for interviews and photo ops and tickets to their shows or whatever people want from them, free CDs, I don't know. Those people are very businesslike, you know, and it doesn't mean that they're not nice, but they know that it's show business. It's not, you know, it's not a fun thing. It may be a fun thing to do, but this is their livelihood. And they have to manage their time, and they have to manage what they say. And it doesn't mean that they're not nice.
One of the things that is difficult about this business is often there can be a 20-hour travel day to get to where you're going to do a two-hour set, followed by getting on the bus for another 12 hours to get to the next place, and the sound check is bad. And somewhere in that second day, maybe, you've been out there for 40 hours. You haven't really slept in a bed or eaten anything that was good. And somebody says, "Hey, can you sign this for me?" you can make the mistake of going, "Look, just give me a minute, okay?" And they'll say, "What a jerk."
Right.
You know, and so you really have to be on your guard. I've been guilty of that a time or two, and unfortunately there's one guy in Omaha that I need to say I'm sorry to from 1978, but I haven't run across him again. I don't think he's going to show up. But in general, it's a tough game. You also catch people. Okay, here's a question I'm curious about. You go in for a 15-minute interview. Does it turn into 30 sometimes? Like this?
Oh, all the time. It's very rare. I mean, very rare that you go for a half an hour interview and don't spend more time with them. It's very rare, and that's my experience.
Well, that's a compliment. That's a compliment to your style, your writing and interviewing. It's also an indication of how Elmore Magazine is, I believe, for those that are curious, Elmore Magazine, named after who and why?
Elmore James, who was an old blues guy who basically invented slide guitar as we know it today.
Mm-hmm.
What, you have a different impression of Elmore James?
No, I'm just curious why you chose him.
Oh, because it's an American kind of common, when I say common, I don't mean usual. I mean, you'll never find a Sir Elmore wandering around. It's a man of the people kind of name, and it's catchy, and most real music fans know who he is or recognize something about it. You know, we had 2 days worth of figuring out what name we were going to name this magazine. It also fits on a masthead.
I got a suggestion for your magazine.
Please.
Every month you have a little square that says Elmore Facts, and it's things like, bought his first slide when he was 12, or stuff like that.
Oh, I don't think he bought a slide ever. No. I think he used bottlenecks, whatever he could find.
Well, my point is a little square that would tell people the Elmore fact of this issue is...
I hope to be in business long enough to run out of those facts about Elmore James, so we could start with him and move on to other people, Robert Johnson or Woody Guthrie or somebody like that. I think, you know, icons of their genres. I think that's a great idea. Thank you. Do I owe you 2% or something on that?
Just another issue, maybe.
Okay.
Do you consider this Americana music? What is it? Folk music, like Elmore James and some of the people you cover in general?
Americana is a pretty broad concept, and I think it fits in with what we're doing. I think some of the rock and roll that we cover would not necessarily be considered Americana. And I think of people like ZZ Top and... I can think of their song, but I can't think of the band.
Mm.
Oh, anyways, I just dropped it. I'm sorry. But there are some people I think who would not be considered Americana that we cover, but I think 80% of what we cover is Americana. And that, to me, includes blues and folk and, American music, not classical, not world music, mm-hmm. not synthesizers, but something based out of the American heritage, as it were.
I want to make a statement that I want your approval of, and it can be edited out. And I'm curious, is what made you start basically a new career, a new business somewhere you went? And the reason I bring this up, a lot of our listeners are definitely in our age bracket. And you didn't say, I'm done. You said, I'm going to start a magazine and make it a hit. What made you do that?
Well, I had been retired for a little while, and I'd done reasonably well in my previous life, and I got bored. And this friend of mine, Arnie Goodman, who was now my partner in the magazine, kept saying, "Oh, I know. I was doing the newsletter for the New York Blues Society, which I helped start with a couple of other people. And I wound up raising my hand once too often and becoming the editor of the newsletter. And my friend Arnie kept saying to me, "Oh, Suzanne, you should do a real magazine. You should do a real magazine," because this was, a 16-page newsletter. And we sat around in my living room and cooked this up. I didn't really realize that we were in business until I got a $1,400 bill from the copyright office for the trademark of the name. And I'm going, wow, this is a lot of money. I thought, we're in business. We're going to do this. And, we've been doing it ever since.
What's your average? You started 6 years ago, about, and what's your average circulation now?
Okay, it runs around 20,000.
That's really healthy. That's a
huge.
Great, you know, but I believe as the word spreads of this cool magazine, and it's going to grow for sure. And how do people find it?
Well, we're in Barnes & Nobles across the country. We've got a, which does not mean every Barnes & Nobles, but we are in Barnes & Nobles across the country, and we'd love to be in every one of them. You have to go in and ask in some cases. We're available by subscription, which you can get to from www.elmoremagazine.com. And occasionally we go to music festivals where we distribute the magazine. We'll be at the ASCAP conference in Los Angeles in the end of April, getting the word out. And there's always a new way to make people aware of the magazine, and we're trying all of them, frankly.
Do you have a Facebook page?
We do have a Facebook page. It's Elmore Magazine, I believe.
Do you do Twitter?
We tweet from time to time. I personally tweet very little, but we have younger people in the audience, under 50 people in the audience, in the office, who are more likely to tweet than I.
Well, you said a phrase that's very important to the current music business, but it's always been important, is getting the word out. Lately, it's just more difficult than ever in the information age, when there's 15,000 websites for, well, probably 150,000 websites for new music, and there's places to go, and there's new bands and new songs, and it's like everybody's firing off shotguns, and you can't find any of the bullets. And it's getting the word out is what made the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band have a career. We had people writing about us in the 70s as much as giving us airplay. A lot of the airplay we got, the stations didn't identify that it was the group that made the record. They just played the record and went on, you know.
And you didn't have the advantage of having someone be able to Google your lyrics and find out who
right.
wrote it or who performed it.
And getting the word out, having people talk about new music, which you do a lot, and understanding where it came from, I think it's really great that Elmore pays homage to where a lot of things came from, like your jazz issue with All About Jazz and Dizzy Gillespie and Louis Armstrong and everybody. It's a great, that's one of the best reads on jazz I've ever seen. It explains it for people that don't really listen to it.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I had a lot of fun writing that, and I love the guy from Lincoln Center, the head of the Lincoln Center jazz operation, who said, I want the day to come when Duke Ellington's picture is in every classroom, just the way Lincoln's picture or George Washington's picture is.
Well, as well it should be. That would be a good thing.
One thing I'd love to emphasize here is that people should go out and hear live music. They really should. It's an exhilarating experience. I know that, you know, it's much easier to YouTube somebody, but going out and hearing a whole set of a live musician, something that you'll never hear again. I mean, nobody can ever do the same performance exactly the same every time. And you're standing in a different part of the room. I mean, Les Paul told me that. He said he can't go to the movies because he sits in one seat, and then he sits in another, and then he sits in the third, trying to find the best audio experience in the theater. but there's so much out there, as you say, that it's hard to separate what's good and what's not. And that's one of the functions I think that Elmore is trying to perform, which is to sift out some of the chaff and to guide readers to decent music. Some people say to us, oh, Suzanne, you never run a bad review. You never pan anybody. And I say, no, the people that we don't like just don't get ink. That's all. why should we waste, you know, a few precious inches of column space saying, don't buy this album? We only talk about people that we think are good. But good.
Yeah, there's a lot of hard-working, good people. There's a lady in Brooklyn that just works her tail off singing, and she's really good, but she has to have a regular job in order to pay for it. And Martha Redbone is an example. Well, she's not the one I was thinking of, but Martha Redbone is someone I'm working on a project with. You've met her before, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I mean, this is her life, music. She's always talking about it, working on it, and people need to know how good she is. And you're mm-hmm. offering that service, and it's a wonderful thing.
And encouraging people to go out and hear her, go to festivals. I mean, festivals are some of the best values you'll get. You can go for free, you can go for $25, you can go for $40, and hear a day's worth of music, maybe 3 days worth of music, from 11 o'clock in the morning until 11 o'clock at night. Where can you do that?
The other girl I was talking about is Jen Larson.
Oh, yeah.
And she's like an Irish dement type of singer, but mm-hmm. she can't make the other side of the word work for her yet, music business.
Mm-hmm.
And
I have to say that I went to a seminar recently, and I heard a guy talk about funding his band,
mm-hmm.
and they had some very creative things to do. Can I give you an example or two? Because
sure.
I was blown away. He had somebody in the band who was a baker, and they said who knew how to bake,
mm-hmm.
and they said for $500. We will bake you your wedding cake. It's a $500 donation to the band to put out their next CD. And they got 100 people who wanted wedding cakes at $500 a pop. They'll sell signed lyrics. They'll come and perform at your house, you know, for a fixed fee, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And that fee goes to producing their album or funding their tour or buying gas, and they tell you what it's for. It was a very interesting concept, and I think a lot of young bands are doing that. And if they and
young
the,
bands I've
well,
got some I've got some brownies in the oven right now. In fact, I've got about 900 pounds of brownies. It's such a good idea. I'm taking off right now. That's a good idea.
Yeah, there are a lot of ways, and you know, and we recently did a story about syndication and sync rights, not syndication, sync rights, and how young bands can support themselves, maybe not terribly well in the beginning, but they can support themselves by selling music to commercials, to television programs, as background music to something. And maybe you don't feel like you're getting your artistic due, but you get $8,000 and up, and you know that buys some strings for your guitar, and that buys some food and rent.
What the listener may not know is when Suzanne says sync rights, that means the right to synchronize the music with some form of picture or something, whether it's a commercial or a dance or something. And music
a
has
movie.
Rights.
Yeah,
a movie, and the right to use that is something that's paid for separately. And that doesn't mean they own the song. It means they own the right to use the song in their own way. And it is definitely a way to help raise funds. And commercials, what's the difference between a commercial and a commercial song? If, you know, Paul Williams rode into town in a stolen car in L.A. and he was working on a bank commercial, and somebody said, "Hey, is that a whole song?" And he said, "Well, not really. We'll finish it." And I know this group is just recording, and they can use that. It was a song we've only just begun, and he finished it, and they gave it to the carpenters that were working in the
wow.
studio a floor down, and he paid for the stolen car.
That's it. That is a success story. That's great. I have one from the opposite side, where, oh, I don't know, 20 years ago, maybe more, I heard a commercial on television for Lifesavers, and it was Mint Lifesavers, and in the background was this very terrific harmony going rain, 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 and I went around to every record store I know, and there were record stores then. There was Sam Goody's and Tower Records. And I went around singing this song and looking for it, and it was Ladysmith's Black Mambazo.
Oh.
Nobody had heard of them, but they had gotten there. And, I went out and bought the album. I have, you know, an LP of Ladysmith's Black Mambazo, their first release. But I found them, and I have to say, with some effort, because of a commercial that they were on.
Well, what's his name? Barry Manilow did a lot of commercials in the early days. And I never will forget one of the first concerts that the Dirt Band did in the South was in Davidson, North Carolina. And Bojangles was huge. And we were playing the main concert hall, 1,500 seats. Oh, it doesn't need to get any bigger than this. And the guy that booked us says, come with me for a little while. He took me downstairs to, I booked this duo down here. I want to see what you think of them. And he paid them $500 to play for 4 hours, and it was Bette Midler and Barry Manilow.
Oh, my God.
and I say that for a couple of reasons. You never know where something's going to go. Original music will lead you towards better things. And persistence. And you, Suzanne, have had a lot of persistence with your magazine and your work. And I just wanted to say, direct people again. We're talking to Suzanne Kajin, editor and owner of Elmore Magazine, one of the coolest new music magazines out there. And if you like music, you'll love Elmore.
Thank you very much, Kevin. I have to say that you call me persistent. My friends call me stubborn, but I really appreciate that shift.
Well, to make anything succeed, I believe it takes persistence, according to Napoleon Hill, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not persistent, all persistence is an expression of belief in what you're doing. And
that's true, and it also tends to make you better at it. There was a famous golfer who said, one of the early golfers said, golf is a game of luck. The more I practice, the luckier I get.
I like Bing Crosby's quote. He was about 85 years old. There, somebody was asking him in Palm Springs about life and stuff. He goes, "Well, for a golfer, I did pretty good as a singer."
Oh, that's great.
Well, Suzanne, it's been great visiting with you. And if there's anything you would like to impart to the audience that may be listening, what would that be?
It would be probably go and see John McEwen live.
No, you can't do that. Edit point. Thank you.
Get out and see live music. Read about it. Learn about it. The more you know about it, about music, the more you'll appreciate it. You really will. It makes a huge difference to listen to music, really listen to it, as opposed to have it background music and to hear individual songs on random on your iPod. Listen to
right.
Listen to several songs, an album if you can, by one performer straight through and get a sense of who they are. And believe me, you'll appreciate it. And you'll probably like some songs that you wouldn't have heard on the radio or wouldn't be downloading from iTunes.
Thanks for visiting with us on the Americana Music Show. This is John McEwen speaking with Suzanne Kajin.
Thank you so much, John. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Thank you.